All right, let's dive into the world of biblical prophecy. Today, we're tackling the authorship of Isaiah and Daniel, and we've got these lecture notes from a seminary class on the foundations of prophecy. They're surprisingly engaging. Have you ever thought about who actually wrote these books? Like, how do scholars even begin to figure that out?
It's a real head-scratcher, isn't it? You've got the traditional view, saying Isaiah and Daniel wrote the books named after them. But some scholars have started to question that, and it's sparked some pretty heated debates.
Okay, so let's start with Isaiah. Our notes jump right into this two Isaiahs theory. Why is that even a question?
Well, the book of Isaiah has two main parts, chapters 139 and then 40 to 66. And there are some noticeable differences between them. Like, the first part is very much focused on rebuking Israel for their sins and predicting exile. But then you get to the second part, and it's all about comforting those in exile and promising their return.
Wow, that's a pretty big difference in tone. But couldn't it just be the same prophet speaking to different situations? You know, tough love one minute, consolation the next.
It's possible, but the historical context makes things a bit more complicated. Isaiah lived in the 8th century BC. But the second part of the book refers to the Babylonian exile, which happened over a century later. It even mentions Cyrus by name, the Persian king, who allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem.
Okay, so that does seem a little hard to explain unless Isaiah was some kind of time traveler.
Right, it's a bit of a conundrum. So what are the two Isaiah's proponents saying?
What's their evidence?
A few things, actually. First, there's that shift in focus and historical context we just talked about. Then you've got some interesting linguistic differences. Scholar S.R. Driver noted variations in vocabulary and grammar between the two sections, particularly in the use of first-person pronouns. The second part of Isaiah seems to prefer ani, while earlier prophets, including Isaiah in the first part, often use anoki.
So it's kind of like a language evolution, the way we don't speak exactly like Shakespeare anymore. But wouldn't that suggest a later writer was trying to imitate Isaiah's style?
It's one way to look at it. Think of it like an artist's signature. You see a painting with a certain brushstroke and color palette, you might assume it's by a specific artist. But what if you find another painting attributed to that same artist, but with a slightly different brushstroke? It raises questions, right?
It definitely makes you wonder if there's something else going on. But what about those historical discrepancies? Could it be that the second part of Isaiah was meant to offer hope to those who would eventually face exile, even during Isaiah's lifetime? Maybe it was a message intended for future generations dealing with similar struggles.
That's an interesting idea. And remember, the northern kingdom of Israel had already been exiled by the Assyrians during Isaiah's time. So the people of Judah were no strangers to the possibility of exile. Perhaps those prophecies had a dual purpose, providing comfort in the present and also speaking to the future.
Okay, I'm starting to see how the pieces could fit together. But what about those linguistic differences? Do any scholars address that from a single author perspective?
Absolutely. Rachel Margalioth, in her book, The Indivisible Isaiah, argues that there are some striking similarities in language and unique expressions. And these similarities are shared between both sections of the book.
Hold on. So now we've got scholars on both sides of this debate, each with their own sets of evidence.
That's right. And it's not just about gut feelings or interpretations anymore. With computer analysis being used in biblical studies, we can now look at things like word frequency, sentence structure, and even the use of specific phrases more scientifically. But here's the thing. Even with these fancy tools, there's still no easy answer. The data can be interpreted in a way that supports either side.
So even technology can't solve this ancient mystery. Looks like we'll have to use our brains for this one. Let's circle back to the idea of one Isaiah. If those historical references in the second part seem so out of place, how do single author proponents make sense of that?
They argue that if God can reveal the future to other prophets, why couldn't Isaiah have received revelations about events happening centuries after time? It really depends on your view of prophecy. If you believe in divine inspiration, then those seemingly impossible things become possible.
I see how that could change the whole conversation. But what about those who see the linguistic differences as evidence for multiple authors? How do they respond to the arguments for stylistic unity?
Many of them, even while acknowledging the unity in themes and language, propose what they call redactional unity.
Wait, redactional unity? That sounds like something out of a science fiction movie. What does that even mean?
Imagine this. Instead of one author, you have an editor. A master compiler who takes various writings, maybe even prophecies from different disciples of Isaiah, and weaves them together into a single cohesive book. It's even possible they imitated Isaiah's style to create a sense of continuity.
So it's like a greatest hits album, but for prophecy. That adds a whole new layer of intrigue to this debate, but wouldn't that raise some theological questions? Like, if it's a compilation, does that change how we understand prophetic inspiration?
It's a great question, and one that scholars are constantly grappling with. If it's a single author inspired by God, it seems straightforward. But if there were multiple authors or editors involved, it gets more complicated. How does that affect our understanding of the text's authority and origin? It's a complex issue with no simple answers.
We're definitely in deep waters now. I'm starting to realize this debate is about way more than just figuring out who wrote what. It touches on our fundamental beliefs about prophecy, inspiration, and how we interpret scripture.
You're absolutely right. That's what makes these ancient texts so captivating. They push us to think critically, wrestle with different perspectives, and ultimately arrive at our own conclusions.
Okay, before we move on to the book of Daniel, which is just as intriguing, I want to check in with our listeners. What are your thoughts so far? Does the two Isaiahs theory seem convincing, or are you leaning towards the idea of a single author, maybe with some editorial assistance?
What jumps out at you the most? The linguistic evidence, the historical discrepancies, or the theological implications? It's remarkable how a single book can spark so many different lines of inquiry.
Okay, so we've navigated the twists and turns of Isaiah's authorship. Now let's jump into the equally fascinating world of Daniel.
Get ready for a wild ride. This one's full of historical puzzles and prophecies that seems almost too detailed to be true.
I'm all buckled in. So refresh my memory. What's the traditional view on who wrote Daniel?
Traditionally, it's understood that Daniel himself wrote the book, you know, back in the 6th century BC during the Babylonian exile. Seems logical, right?
Yeah, pretty straightforward, but I'm sensing there's a but coming.
Of course, here come the critical scholars. And just like with Isaiah, they're proposing a much later date for when Daniel was written. They put it around 165 BC during the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes.
Whoa, hold up. You're saying Daniel was written centuries after the events it describes. What makes them think that?
Those incredibly specific prophecies, particularly the ones about future events, are a big factor. You see, a lot of critical scholars operate under the assumption that accurately predicting the future is just impossible.
I get that. If you don't believe prophecy is possible, then those detailed predictions in Daniel would definitely raise some eyebrows.
Exactly. So they suggest the book was actually written after those events happened, during a time when the Jews were facing intense persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes. It was a way to offer hope and encouragement by reinterpreting past events as prophecies that foreshadowed their current struggles.
Like saying, hey, things might be tough now, but it was all predicted. And based on these prophecies, we know we'll win in the end.
You got it. It's a pretty clever strategy when you think about it. But that prophecy is impossible argument isn't the only thing they point to. They also bring up what they see as historical inconsistencies or inaccuracies in the book.
Oh, I love a good historical mystery. Give me an example.
Okay, well, when describing the fall of Babylon, Daniel names Belshazzar as the king. But history tells us that the last king of Babylon was actually Nabonidus. Seems like a pretty big mistake, right?
You would think you'd get the ruler's name right if you're writing a historical account. Are they saying Daniel just made things up?
Not necessarily. It might not be as simple as it seems. Historical records actually show that Belshazzar served as co-regent with his father, Nabonidus. It's entirely possible Belshazzar was the one in charge when Babylon fell, which would make Daniel's account completely accurate.
Ah, so it's more a case of us missing some information rather than Daniel being intentionally wrong?
Exactly. And it's a good reminder that we're working with ancient texts which are often incomplete and open to different interpretations. What looks like an error to us might just reflect how history was understood and recorded back then.
Fair enough. But what about those other supposed historical errors in Daniel? Our notes mention something about a mysterious king that no one seems to be able to find.
You're talking about Darius the Mede. Daniel describes him as the ruler who came after Belshazzar. The problem is there's no external historical evidence to confirm he existed. It's like he just vanished.
Okay, now that does sound a little suspicious. Did Daniel just make up a king to fit his narrative?
Let's not jump to conclusions. While it's true there's no outside confirmation, there are some possible explanations. Some scholars believe that Darius was actually a throne name used by Cyrus, the Persian king who conquered Babylon. Others suggest it could refer to someone like Gubaru, a governor appointed by Cyrus to rule Babylon.
So it's like we're missing a few pieces of the puzzle. Maybe with more archaeological discoveries or a better understanding of how names were used back then, things will become clearer.
Exactly. History is rarely black and white, especially when we're dealing with ancient sources. It's more like shades of gray. And we need careful analysis and an open mind to get closer to what really happened.
I'm sensing a pattern here. First, we had the prophecy is impossible argument, then those historical discrepancies. And now our notes bring up linguistic evidence that supposedly points to a later date for Daniel. Are we about to see those linguistic fingerprints again?
You know it. Just like with Isaiah, scholars have analyzed Daniel's language, grammar, and vocabulary. They compare it to other texts from different periods, and some of them argue that certain features point to a later date of composition, closer to the Maccabean era.
So they're saying Daniel's language sounds more like someone writing in the 2nd century BC than the 6th century BC.
That's the basic idea. They might point to specific words or grammatical structures that weren't commonly used during Daniel's supposed lifetime, suggesting a later author who was more familiar with the language of that time period.
Okay, I can see how that would strengthen their argument, but honestly, that whole prophecy is impossible thing still feels like a major obstacle. It seems like you'd have to completely reject that idea to accept the traditional authorship of Daniel.
You hit the nail on the head, and that's where this debate gets really interesting. It forces us to examine our own assumptions about the world, the limits of what we can know, and whether something supernatural can actually happen in the natural world.
Wow, we're getting philosophical now. But I have to admit, I love these kinds of conversations. It's not just about historical facts and analyzing language. It's about grappling with those big questions that have puzzled people for centuries.
Couldn't agree more. And don't forget, even if we don't fully accept those late-dating theories, engaging with them helps us sharpen our critical thinking skills and forces us to look at the evidence more closely.
It's like a mental workout, pushing us to think outside our comfort zones.
Exactly. And who knows, maybe by wrestling with these different viewpoints, we'll uncover new insights and deepen our understanding of these ancient texts, regardless of when they were written or by whom.
So before we finish up our deep dive into Daniel, I want to ask our listeners something. Imagine you're a detective trying to solve this authorship mystery. What pieces of evidence would stand out to you the most?
And how would you weigh those pieces of evidence? Would you lean towards the traditional view, the idea of a later date, or maybe something in between? There's no right or wrong answer here, just different ways of approaching the puzzle.
Wow, we've really dug deep into these authorship debates. It's amazing how much there is to consider when it comes to the question of who wrote these books.
It really shows how powerful these texts are. They still spark curiosity and debate even centuries after they were written.
It's like we're peeling back layers of history, language, and theology all at the same time. As we wrap up this deep dive into the authorship of Isaiah and Daniel, what key takeaways should our listeners remember?
Well, I think the most important thing is that there are good arguments on both sides of these debates, whether you're more convinced by the traditional authorship or a later date. There's evidence to support both views, and really smart people have dedicated their lives to studying these questions.
It's not like one side is right and the other is wrong. It seems like your perspective on prophecy plays a big role. If you're open to the idea of divine inspiration, that God can reveal the future, then the traditional authorship of Isaiah and Daniel makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. But if you're more skeptical of prophecy, then the arguments for later authorship, with the focus on historical context and literary techniques, might be more convincing to you.
It's interesting how our own beliefs and assumptions about the world can influence how we read and understand these ancient texts. It's not just about the words themselves, but how we see them.
You said it perfectly, and that's one of the most valuable things we can learn from all this. These debates challenge us to think about our own assumptions, to look at the evidence carefully, and to be open to different perspectives, even when they make us question what we thought we knew.
It's like those optical illusions where you can see two different images depending on how you look at it. These ancient texts are kind of like that. They're different layers of meaning and interpretation.
Exactly. And that's what makes studying scripture so rewarding. It's not just passively absorbing information. It's an active conversation that spans across time. And we get to be a part of it.
I love that image of a conversation that continues through the ages. It reminds us that we're not just listening, we're actively participating in a dialogue that started long ago. So for our listeners, what's the most important thing to remember as they explore these books on their own?
Approach them with humility, be curious, and keep an open mind. Don't be afraid to ask tough questions, consider different points of view, and let the text challenge your own assumptions.
That's great advice. And who knows, maybe by wrestling with these questions, we'll discover something new, not just about Isaiah and Daniel, but about ourselves and our own faith journeys.
Well said. It's often when we're between certainty and doubt, tradition and questioning, that we find the most profound insights.
So true. Well, it looks like it's time to wrap up this deep dive, but before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought. We've looked at the arguments, examined the evidence, and considered different perspectives. Now it's up to you to decide what you think. How will this new knowledge shape your understanding of Isaiah and Daniel? As you continue to explore scripture, remember that the journey is just as important as the destination. Keep asking those tough questions, keep digging deeper, and most importantly, keep the conversation going.